Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Stephen Sclaver. I represent Jonathan Burke as the trustee of the Jack Tarrant Trust. The trial court's judgment below rests on three fundamental and independent legal errors, each of which requires reversal of the judgment. The first is the court erred in its finding that the policy lacked an insurable interest, violating the plain language of then-in-effect Section 110.1E that states that the person applying, if it's the insured, has an unlimited insurable interest in their own life. The second violation below was the court erring in violating the well-known canon of construction as well as the well-known common law and the statutes that rescission requires returning the parties to the status quo ante, to their economic position that they were before the contract was entered into. You can adjust the equities up and down if a party is damaged or if they've conferred undue benefits on the other side, but it cannot be used for punishment as it was here when Lincoln proved no damages. And the third error below, independent of those two grounds, is the prevailing party issue. Here, my client was the party with the net monetary recovery, recovering over $430,000 in premiums plus interest, and the trial court incorrectly found that Lincoln was because it wanted declaratory relief that did not award it any money. The decision also violates five independent and reasonably new, a lot of this was submitted on letter briefs after the briefs were submitted, decisions by the Central District of California, all of which have construed nearly identical issues. Most of them are by Judge Pregerson. There's one by Judge Larson, one of which is even from January of 2011. That's the Principal versus Wells Fargo case.
In any of those cases, did the trial court find that the insurance policy was procured by fraud and based on, as the court called it in this case, spectacular fraud?
Well, in the Principal versus Wells Fargo case, for example, that case was decided on a motion to dismiss where you have to assume, or a motion to strike as well, where you assume the allegations are true. And in those cases, the allegations were made that this was a fraud. I don't know if the rhetoric spectacular was used in that complaint, but yes, the allegations were that this was a fraud. Likewise, in the Fishman case, Judge Larson's case from 2009, that was on a motion for summary judgment where all the inferences were drawn that this was an entire fraud where they lied to Lincoln about issues of insurable interest, where they lied about the intent behind the policies. And in those situations, all those courts held, that's an issue about lack of insurable interest.
Intent may be one thing, but in this case, the court found that the documents that were presented to verify the assets were completely fabricated, and that there was nothing out there, that basically that the insured was kind of a shill and that this was a scam from the outset.
There are two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is that wasn't the basis for rescission because findings of fraud are barred by the incontestability statutes.
Well, if a policy is void ab initio for fraud, then it would seem that that provision would be void also. But that's not what I wanted to ask you about. What I wanted to focus on was in the statement of decision, the court makes a statement that is somewhat difficult to understand if what you're saying is correct. In paragraph 23, the court says, because the court has determined that the Tarrant policies were fraudulently procured, lack an insurable interest, and are void ab initio, the court does not have to address Lincoln's misrepresentation claim. So, you know, procured by fraud and misrepresentations in an application are not necessarily the same thing. And contracts that are procured by fraud at the inception are legally void.
Your Honor, we disagree with that. That would violate quite a few California cases, including Supreme Court cases. An example is the imposter defense case. That's the Amex Life Insurance case. I think it's from I can't remember the year. I'll get to the year in a moment. In that case, there was an insured who had HIV, and he sent to the medical examination someone who didn't have HIV. And, of course, that person took the test and passed, and the policy was enacted. In that case, the insurance company challenged it and said, look, this is procured by fraud. You sent an imposter to the medical exam. I didn't enter into a contract with you. I entered into a contract with that person who went to the medical exam. It should be void ab initio. The Supreme Court in that case, American Life Assurance, rejected that argument and held it's barred by the incontestability statutes. It's not just a provision in the contract. It's a statute that cannot be waived by the parties. So that's why if there was a procurement by fraud, that wasn't the grounds or can't be the grounds as a matter of law for voiding the policy.
What did the court mean when it said, because the court has determined that the policies were fraudulently procured, lack an insurable interest, and are void ab initio, the court doesn't have to address the misrepresentation claim?
Your Honor, I think the court made an error. That's an error as a matter of law. The policy cannot be rescinded on the grounds of fraud. That would overturn all the incontestability jurisprudence. Another case, it's one we cite in our reply brief, is the John Hancock case. That's the one that lays out, although people may think incontestability enriches fraudsters, it's put in place for the benefit of good-hearted citizens who want assurance that after they die or after the two-year period, insurance companies don't start rummaging through their files and gin up a new fraud claim where those claims don't have merit. I understand on this record there is a finding that we are not contesting on appeal that there was spectacular fraud in the procurement of the policy, but the statutes enacted prohibit contesting and voiding those policies on those grounds after 2 years.
I think we're relying on the provision in the policy.
It's both. We rely on both, Your Honor, but it's a statute as well under California law.
Well, a misrepresentation is a form of fraud.
Correct. And in fact, a fraud is defined, I believe, in the civil code, and that includes the definition, includes a misrepresentation. It's the same thing. And so it's our argument on the rescission element that a court can't skirt the incontestability bar, that's both case law, two Supreme Court cases, in the contract, as well in statute, by finding there's misrepresentation in a policy that's voided for lack of insurable interest and then somehow punish my client in a rescission case, which under the case law requires the return of the parties to the status quo ante. And the cases on that are on point. The first case is the Runyon case from the California Supreme Court. In that case, that's a situation where a party entered into a franchise contract. And he went to the new business, quit his old job, sued for rescission, got his franchise fee back, but also got loss of income for quitting his job. And the court marched through, they marched through the civil code, 1691 and 1692, and said the phrase adjustment of the equities in 1692 means that if a rescinding party is damaged or has conferred benefits on the non-rescinding party, you can use equity to make sure the rescinding party is back in the same economic position they were before the contract was entered into. Here, Lincoln proved $0 in damages. They lost on every damage model they put forth. And yet the court, in our view, unlawfully used rescission as a punishment and punished my client. Now it's over $2 million, if that includes interest, by allowing the company to keep the premiums even though the policy was rescinded. That violates the premise in the statute that you have to return the parties to the status quo ante. It violates a decision from the Fourth District. That's the L.A. Sound case from 2007. In that case, you had D's and O's who received insurance coverage defense costs in a case. Then the policy was rescinded. The carrier sued to get back the defense costs. The trial court awarded the defense costs back on a joint and several liability basis. This district reversed and said, no, you have to prove the specific benefits awarded to each D&O, and the case was remanded for that fact-finding determination. Rescission can't be used as punishment, and if it were, it's our argument that then would be unconstitutional because you have no damages and yet an award, essentially, of $2 million to the carrier. Now, what's important on the statute, and when I'm quoting the statute, 101.10.1e, that subsection, that's on the insurable interest issue, that's the prior statute. The statute has changed. It's now been redesignated as G. The statute changed in 2000. It's effective prospectively in 2010, and in fact, it was a big battle. There was a prior version of the statute that Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed, and then it was enacted. Didn't need a veto at that point. It got through. It was enacted around October and effective going forward. And there's a new subsection F and a new subsection E, and those subsections provide that you can't use a scheme to help duck the insurable interest laws. But as the law was in place at the time my clients formed these transactions, the law allowed an insured to take out a policy on his own life if he's the applicant Lincoln conceded he's the applicant. Jack Tarrin was the applicant. They said so in their operative complaint, paragraph 26. They said so in their trial brief, I think four different places, pages 4, 11, 22, and 24. They said so in opening arguments, and they said so during the bench trial. There was colloquy with the court. So in those situations, and the evidence is undisputed, he signed the application and signed the amendments. The insured here was the applicant.
It could have been anybody, right? I mean, nobody had the assets. It could have been any older person, apparently.
Well, if it was any older person, that would be a different argument that he didn't sign the
Well, it seems to me that, I guess we'll hear from the other side, but I think part of their no insurable interest argument is based on the big picture, as the court articulated.
In the Fishman court and other, in the Boyer court, addressing how insurance policies are just like contracts, hold, you can't try and pierce behind the corporate formalities of these contracts to figure out what's going on. And so if you look at the contract, the way it was structured, the insured was the applicant. Has an unlimited insurable interest in his or her own life. He or she can do whatever she wants with the policy. That's recognized in the Boyer case from 1929 in the California Supreme Court. That's how this deal was structured, and that's how the law then, in effect, permitted it to be structured.
Do you think that a $20 million policy would have been issued if not for the fraudulent accounting documents that were submitted?
No, it would not have been issued. And in fact, but the fraud claim is what was time barred, and there's a statute of repose.
I think in the other cases there is not an allegation that the assets were phonied up, as there is in this case.
I believe, even in the new cases in the Central District of California, the five new cases, I know there are allegations of schemes. I can't remember if there's issues of net worth, but the reason why there's a fraud is not really relevant. I think what's relevant is the fact there was a fraud. For example, in McEwen, that's the 1921 California Supreme Court case that held even in cases of fraud, rescission requires a return of all premiums. In that case, you had a person who lied on his application about whether or not he'd been in an accident recently. In that case, he'd been in an accident the prior year that rendered him temporarily disabled for 4 months. It was a gross fraud. The word fraud is littered all over the decision. And in that case, the court ordered the return of premiums to the insured.
Yeah, I'm not focusing on that aspect of it. I'm focusing on the other aspect.
And here there was no issue, as I understand it, on the medical exam, so that on a life expectancy examination, Lincoln was perfectly satisfied and there was no misrepresentation of fraud or anything else which would have formed the basis for the issuance of the policy and the premiums charged.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no health misrepresentation. This is an odd situation of a company.
No, but you just conceded that they wouldn't have issued a $20 million policy if not for the phony accounting document.
That's true. That's true, Your Honor. But the point is that this isn't an issue about health that impacts the risk of the insured living and the economics of the transaction. This is an odd case of a company suing a customer for paying all of its bills on time. That's what this case is about. And that's why they're...
Some might say that, and some might say it's a scam from beginning to end.
Oh, that complied with the letter, with the law. And the reason the carriers view it as a scam, I mean, if this really were life gambling, there would be evidence in the record that Lincoln had a life expectancy of X for Jack Tarrin, and the investors had a life expectancy of Y, with Y being shorter than X. There's no evidence of that in the record. What this business model is, and this is discussed with Judge Meyer below, it's called lapse ratio arbitrage. The carriers issued a policy on a 79-year-old man for $20 million, charging $909,000 a year in premiums. It's not because they thought he was going to live to 100. It's because on balance, over a basket of cases, insureds default on their premium payments. They lapse on it. Investors step in and make sure that they don't default. That's what this business issue is about. And so it's really a fight over that business model. But in any event, the plain language of the statute allows a person applying, that's the language.
To present phony financial information to get a $20 million policy?
No, of course it does not allow that for that, except the fraud claim is time barred. You cannot skirt the incontestability statutes or the two California Supreme Court decisions on this issue, and that's not even an issue.
Well, that wasn't even appealed.
That wasn't even appealed. That's right. There was no cross appeal on their loss on the material misrepresentation claim. The only argument they try and make is to try and bootstrap that claim as grounds to get the premiums back, but that would violate the plain language of the civil code as well as 41 and 43.5.
And at least arguably, if they were concerned about your client's ability to pay the premiums, they would have been happy to find out that there were a group of investors who were underwriting the whole damn thing, because then they could get their $1 million a year in premiums, which is what they wanted after they approved the medical.
Correct, Your Honor, or even more, they wanted a lapse. They wanted the insured, they want the elderly to stop paying premiums because then they get to keep it all. But that's not what happened here. The investors stepped in, paid all the bills on time, and now we're in a lawsuit brought untimely on the fraud claim. Insurable interest claims cannot be waived under California law, which is one of the reasons in Delaware, there's a District of Delaware decision, the Lincoln versus Snyder case, the court held, we're not going to allow a regime where a carrier can wait as long as they want, because insurable interest claims can't be waived, sue to rescind, collect all the premiums in the interim, and then keep all the premiums. That disincentivizes them to bring their cases sooner to the detriment of people that pay premiums. And in our case, Lincoln, the evidence was undisputed, knew that this was an alleged STOLE scheme by March of 2008, collected another $100,000 in premiums from my clients the next month in April, and then sued 3 weeks later, and then kept collecting premiums, and finally in closing arguments stipulated to return the money they collected after litigation commenced, which is really no principled distinction recognized in the statutes. Rescission requires returning the parties to the status quo that they were before the contract was entered into. There can be an adjustment if they suffered damages or conferred benefits. That didn't happen here. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, either the policy should be reinstated because it complies with the plain language of the statute, or if it's rescinded, we should get all of our premiums back plus interest so the parties are returned to their economic position before the deal. And independent of those, my client received the net monetary recovery, and under the plain language of the Code of Civil Procedure 1032, there's no trial court discretion in that situation. We should get our costs both at trial and on appeal. I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Your Honors.